Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as I bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I am your guest host and international kindness expert, speaker, and author, Gabriela Van Rey. Kindness stands central in everything I undertake. From the Dare to Be Kind movement, as most of you listeners already know, I've been on the road for 11 months. Trekking throughout the USA. But I came off the road in the beginning of October to take a well-deserved pause, because living in a tent, even though it's comfortable on top of my roof, it is truly exhausting. But next year, I will continue my adventure to bring the message that you too can be the difference to everyone in the USA and beyond. And according to Alan Cardoza, this makes me a perfect fit to host today's show in his absence. And I want everyone to know out there that when Alan is absent, he's absent because he's doing really amazing things. He is being the difference in someone's life. As a private eye, he's probably helping a runaway teen or someone in trouble. So we wish you good luck, Alan, and hope that you return soon and safe. Okay, now Alan is asking you for a favor. We need your help. Without your help, our show cannot exist. So please become a show ambassador by forwarding at least one show to your social media group, or just tell a friend. And that is the way that we will exponentially reach more and more people. Each week, this show addresses issues like locating runaway teens, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addiction, increasing the quality of your life and your longevity, and so much more. Alan has told me that he and Jan Shapen, the show producer, choose top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors that they believe are working to make this world a better place for us all. And so let's get moving on to our guest today, which is Carla Yanni. She's a professor of art history at Rutgers University. She is the author of The Architecture of Madness, Insane Asylums in the U.S., and Nature's Museums, Victorian Science and the Architecture of Display. She earned the doctorate in art history from the University of Pennsylvania and a BA from Wesleyan University. And I hope I said Wesleyan correctly. I never know. The topic of today is Living on Campus, an Architectural History of the American Dormitory. And I already told our guests that this is so exciting. So a little bit about her bio. Pressman provides a new and comprehensive understanding of fierce, subtleness mechanism. This college dormitory, places of exclusion as much as sites of fellowship, have an uncertain future. In clear, elegant prose, Carla Yanni tracks 350 years of architectural history of the college dormitory and exposes its contested social meanings, marked by inclusion and exclusion on the basis of class, gender, and race. This is a remarkable achievement, a welcome addition to the architectural history of youth, higher education, and institutions. Martha Gutman, author of A City for Children, said that about our guest. Carla, I am so excited to have you, because the honest truth, I love your topic. Inclusion and exclusion is what I'm all about and trying to teach that. So I'm so glad to have you here on as an expert.
And thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to first of all ask you something. Is how did you get into this? Where did your passion come from to tackle college dormitories?
I was working as a vice president in the central administration here at Rutgers University in New Jersey, mm-hmm. where I teach. And when I was in that administrative job, I used to hear other administrators making fun of these older buildings on campus. They were built in the 1950s, and people would say things like, how could anyone have ever built that? Or why did anyone ever think that was a good idea? Kind of as if earlier administrators, these were people doing the exact same job we were doing in the present, and were, you know, villainous or were, you know, trying to do the wrong thing. And, you know, I knew that wasn't the case. I assumed that those people had the best of intentions. And also as an architectural historian, I could explain the context for why those buildings were built the way they were. And so that was really the beginning to bring to historical buildings a generous understanding of what the architects were attempting to do. Yes, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that dormitories are kind of an overlooked type of building. They are in front of a lot of people all the time. Lots of people have lived in them, but there was no book that looked at them in a serious historical way.
Okay, I understand that. I wouldn't even have thought of it either. But could you tell for the listener and for me, give me an example of a question that they might think is odd? Do you have one like that just on top of your head? Let's say that something in the dormitory is, in our opinion, in 2019 sounds yes. totally odd. Just give me one example so that we can follow you.
Sure. Yeah. The particular buildings that these people disliked were 7 stories tall on one side, 9 stories on the other, because they are on a very steeply pitched hill. They are completely plain with no ornamentation or decoration of any kind. Very simple, long, skinny buildings with long corridors and sort of inexpensive materials like concrete block and very plain brick. So I think that what looked modern and new when it was built in the 1950s looked kind of old and that we were trying to sort of treat the students like prisoners or something like that. So that's just one example. But there are many people who just don't think dormitory buildings should be tall at all.
Interesting. See, thank you for saying that, because I wouldn't have known what it is that they don't like, right? So that gives us a sense.
Right. I think that a lot of people feel that low-rise buildings, buildings that are, say, 3 stories tall, mm-hmm. are more home-like or more domestic. But of course, that brings a certain expectation about what a home is.
Yeah. But later on, we live in apartment buildings, too, right?
Exactly. So maybe I know. That's why I thought it was such a funny complaint.
It's maybe a way to get used to the future. I don't know.
Right.
Okay. So you have researched these dormitories for how long, approximation?
Oh, I started it about 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, to do the research and to go to each campus and look in their archives for historical documents. And try to find out what students felt about the dormitories that they lived in.
Okay. Well, walk us through a little bit of the historically how the dormitory appearances have changed from the 18th century to today.
Okay, sure. The one of the things that you mentioned in your introduction was that living on campus is as much about fellowship and inclusion as it is about exclusion. So it turns out that the first building built in what later became the United States exclusively for housing students was the Indian College at Harvard. And that was built because the white students wouldn't live with Native Americans. So just from the very beginning, there's an idea that some people are inside the group and some people are outside the group. And that kind of became a theme that was threaded throughout the book. So that first, those first buildings were kind of boxy, two or three stories tall. And then there was a period when colleges built a single building for all of the functions of the college. So a chapel and a library and a dining hall, and the professors lived there and the students lived there. Sometimes the president's family lived in the building too. So everyone was all, you know, together in one place. And that didn't last very long because that becomes kind of difficult to, for everyone to live together. Usually the president moved out first. Then a little while later, students, some colleges built dormitories that were especially useful in places where the colleges were in such remote parts of the country that there just weren't enough buildings in the town. So, for example, a college like Williams College in Massachusetts or Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, there just weren't enough boarding houses in the town for the students to live in. Mm-hmm. So they had to live somewhere, so the college built a dormitory. Hmm. Some other changes would be the building of quadrangles. A quadrangle is like a square donut where you have an outdoor room, like the square parts of the building creates an outdoor room. And Oxford and Cambridge had quadrangles, so a lot of American institutions built quadrangles in imitation of that.
Okay. And why did they build that?
Well, I think there was a great admiration for the education at Oxford and Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And Oxford and Cambridge themselves were modeling their buildings on medieval monasteries, which mm-hmm. also had a square kind of courtyard. And in some cases, the monks would walk around that courtyard while they were saying prayers. So that's one possible source for Oxford and Cambridge. And then American educators copied Oxford and Cambridge.
Okay, nice. You know, this is what's so beautiful. Why reinvent the wheel, right? We learn from each other. So
yeah,
I have a question.
Trying to bring those associations.
Yeah, yes. And then embellish what you didn't like, right? Just create your
exactly.
own spin
and
on it.
Exactly, and that's a very good word. I mean, American educators embellished what they found at Oxford
yeah.
and Cambridge.
Yeah, I love it. You said something that immediately popped something into my head when you said that in Harvard, when they built it, that there was a dormitory for the Native Americans and a dormitory for the Caucasians. And something popped in my head, and maybe you don't know this answer, but I thought of asking, do you know if there was a difference in the two dormitories? Because I would, something in me thinks that they might have made a difference in the two.
Well, in that particular case, it was so early in the history of American colleges that the dwellings for the white students were similar to the dwellings for the Native Americans. They weren't that different, but they were quite rudimentary and at that early stage. What's sad is that almost no Native Americans ever graduated from Harvard. It was an idea that people had that it was basically a missionary impulse to convert the Native Americans, and it was a very difficult and kind of abusive environment. So very few Native Americans graduated, and they tore that building down and replaced it with something else. So
I was just going to ask you that.
What is it now? Yeah.
Now, what is it now? Because it would have been beautiful if they had kept it as a sort of lesson for the future in inclusiveness. I don't know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. But there was nothing left of it by 1700. It was gone.
Okay.
So.
Do American educators believe that housing students is essential to educating them?
Well, on a lot of college campuses, there is a very strong feeling among the people in what's called the student affairs department. You know, so the people who, not the academics, but the people who deal with the lives of students, you know, the dining halls and the residence halls and the people who run the counseling centers and so forth, that living on campus is a great, is a way to bond the student to the university, that there's something that we might think of as the, you know, quintessential collegiate experience. Mm-hmm. You break away from your home, you cross this threshold into adulthood, you make a lot of new friends, and all of that social activity, or a lot of that social activity, takes place in the residence hall. So yes, mm-hmm. it is a crucial part of the experience in the minds of many people.
Yeah, I always thought it too. I never did it though. I never lived on campus, but I sometimes think I should have.
Well, I think that's one of the funny things about it is that obviously there are lots of students who commute mm-hmm. and they get educated. You know, they manage to become educated people and they manage to make friends and so forth. But it is harder for them. And they have, you know, there is some social science research about this, and it takes commuters longer to graduate, and it's surprising. You might think it's the other way around, that the commuters would be so focused on their schoolwork, but mm-hmm. and you know, obviously there are other factors at play, but living on campus, belonging to a lot of clubs, getting really involved in the life of the college actually helps people graduate.
Yep. I totally understand that you said that. Really, because I think also just the support, knowing that there's always someone around the corner to help you, to support you, to encourage you not to give up.
Yeah, I think that's so important. Yeah. And absolutely. Something to look forward to. You know, next mm-hmm. semester, there's going to be this event in this club. And, you know, it's a way of keeping people connected. And I also think that living in a residence hall that has resident assistants, and the resident assistants answer to the head residents, and the head residents answer to the, you know, director of residence life or whatever, that's a really strong safety net. Mm-hmm. That's a really powerful way of keeping people from falling through the cracks. And I think by and large it works. Even when some of the residence halls are a little old or a little run down, you still get that support system of people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What's the most important thing that you feel that you learned from your research, from all of them, whether it's the professor, the dean, the student, or even the architects, but what you think was the most important? So I really want to know what you think you learned.
So many things. I think that one of the unsolvable problems is how to make an institution feel like it's not an institution. So a big college, a big state university, you know, here at Rutgers, we have, I think, 28,000 undergraduates and another 8,000 graduate students on this one campus. And then there are many other campuses, too. But how do you create community within a very large institution? That has been a problem for, as colleges grew, that has been a problem, and it's never really been solved. So if you go to a small college, that sort of solves the problem. Of course, there won't mm-hmm. be as many options of majors and things like that, but it does create a community. But if for students who attend an enormous institution, mm-hmm. They have to do something right away within that first semester to create a small community. And it can be anything. It can be a major. It can be the Rubik's Cube Club. It doesn't matter what it is.
To be
but
part of
to be something.
Yeah.
To be part of something and to make, because otherwise, you know, it's just such, it can be such an anonymous, dehumanizing experience. And that's so hard because many students have such high expectations. You know, they think I'm going to go away to college and everything is going to be new and bright and shiny. But it can be the opposite.
Huh. Yeah. I can totally see that. Is that one of the reasons that the young students join the sorority houses?
Yeah,
is that one of the reason too?
And it's historically been the reason. Yeah, when I first started to do the research on the book, it seemed like it was already a big enough topic. And then I thought, well, I can't really write about fraternities and sororities because that's another topic. But then I realized that the history of the two is inextricable. And so I ended up doing some research mostly on fraternities because sororities didn't tend to build houses.
Uh-huh.
And when they did, they weren't that different from any other kind of, house for 20 or 30 young people, the kinds of sometimes what are called cottages on some college campuses. But in the 19th century, colleges and universities were expanding. They needed to spend money on things like laboratories and classrooms, and they just stopped building dormitories and let the fraternities fill in the housing gap.
Mm-hmm.
And those fraternities, this comes back to the inclusion and exclusion question once again, right? So the fraternities created a kind of home-like setting, a substitution for the family, it was referred to in the 19th century. And mm-hmm. they also, if they were wealthy and the recent graduates were wealthy, they would build increasingly elaborate houses. So some very lavishly decorated fraternities were built in the 19th century. And it's very easy to see the class hierarchy playing out in fraternities because the biggest house will have the highest fees. And the only people who can afford to even try to get into that fraternity are the wealthiest students. And white male fraternities that were Protestant would not let in Catholics, and they wouldn't let in Jews, and they wouldn't let in African Americans or Latino students. So, the fraternities became very quickly, the white fraternities became a point of exclusion. And that was a problem because the colleges were relying on them for housing, but there wasn't enough housing. So then the poor young men had to live in boarding houses and they didn't meet anybody and they weren't eating healthy food and they, couldn't get involved in the life of the campus. So that was another reason why colleges started to see the lack of dorms as a problem. And a lot of dormitories were built at the beginning of the 20th century to try to fix that problem.
Okay. And did they fix it?
Yes, I think by and large they did. I mean, a lot of campuses added residence halls without removing the fraternities. So I'm thinking of some place like the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where there was a fairly well-established fraternity culture, but they also wanted the independent students to have a place to live. So they built some very nice dormitories, nothing fancy particularly, just a nice kind of warm, welcoming appearance and a nice scale, not too tall. And within each part of the building, there was a little house, like 40 students would form a little community within the building. And the intended purpose of that was as a leveler to make it so that class differences were not as obvious.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Did you find that on-campus living, does it enhance the moral character of the students?
Well, it certainly was the claim that was made by college officials, like deans of women and deans of men, as they were called.
Why?
It goes back to the earliest days of American colleges when the colleges were mostly places to train people in religion. Mm-hmm. So there were very few courses. You could take math or classics or theology. And the idea was to, you know, some people would go into business, but a lot of people would actually become clerics, you know, would go on to work in religion. And the goal of the university was to shape the student's character.
Okay.
That kind of fell out of the mission of the college over the course of the 19th century and into the 20th century. It became less and less of a goal for the professors, but more and more of a goal for the deans. So even if you look at any college website today and you, mm-hmm. you know, you type in, why should I live in a residence hall, or what are the benefits of living in a dormitory? It won't use the word morality or character, but it'll say something like, you'll be exposed to diversity, you'll have leadership opportunities, you'll learn to get along with other people. Living in the residence hall gives you a chance to experience new things and be a leader. You know, that kind of the way people use the word leadership now kind of replaces the way people used to use character or morality, that you mm-hmm. you become a better version of yourself.
Okay.
And I think that's still very much in the rhetoric of colleges, especially from the student affairs department, maybe okay. not so much on the academic side.
Okay. I'm going to, because it really fits into what we were just discussing, I'm going to have one of the listener questions here.
Sure.
And this is from George in Massachusetts. And he says, I was so happy to see your book on Answers for the Family site. My son is heading off to UCLA next year, and he wants to live in the dorms so that he... he wants to live in the dorms so that he will be closer to his classes. I have some reservations given the school has a party hardy reputation. We live on the East Coast, so I cannot likely be physically present to monitor the situation. I'm not one to wear blinders. So my question mm-hmm. Is this a book that would be a guide for my son, or is it more a guide for the parents like myself, or both?
Oh, well, it's really more of a history book than a guide for anyone. But I definitely sympathize and understand and hear the question. I think especially if you're far away, the residence hall is a good idea.
Okay.
Where else would he live? If he's living in an apartment, there's so little oversight. And then it wastes time he could be in class, you know, if the furnace breaks or if, you know, they get, you know, they have some kind of problem with the apartment. That's a huge waste of time. Far better to have the student in a residence hall and you pay one bill and you know somebody's looking out for the first year student. I mean, once he has a core group of friends, then he could move out. But that's where you meet everybody, I think, is on that, you know, that quintessential experience of the freshman hall.
I love what you just said, because it is really, really true that we don't think as parents of something happening to the apartment. So that's a really, really good point, Carla. But the second
And they're also
point,
often in terrible condition compared to the residence halls. I mean, the residence halls might be modest, right? They might be, you know, concrete blocks and a bathroom at the end of the wall, at the end of the hall. But they get cleaned every day, and they're safe. And
yeah.
As for the partying, you know, that I don't think the residence hall is either a plus or a minus in that regard.
Okay, and then just one more thing here. He's talking about that party hardy reputation.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You want to answer to that? I'm sure you know the campus. Maybe you can put his mind at ease.
UCLA is among the most prestigious, most difficult to get into universities in the United States. So first of all, congratulations to his son. That is very, okay. very impressive. And I don't think of, I mean... I don't know. I think the whatever lessons he's learned as a teenager, he's obviously a responsible kid, or, you know, he's been doing his homework or showing up for his sports teams or whatever, and he'll just have to use his best judgment. But I actually think a residence hall is a safer environment than, well, I think it's a safer environment than a fraternity, again, because of the oversight. You know, there are people, there are resident advisors in the residence hall.
Absolutely. So even if there's a party, George, think of it this way. There are more eyeballs on your son if he's inside than if he would be outside.
That is my strong sentiment. Yes.
Thank you, Carla. Okay, for the listeners out there, we are taking a break right now, and we will be back within a minute.
Hi, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from my film roles such as the Sensei in the Karate Kid films and a variety of others. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100% physically. As fun as it was, I've had to have multiple surgeries from doing some of my own stunts. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from this chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat body and muscle pain without taking medication every day. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength Pain Relief Cream. Our CBD cream is whole plant extracted and made with high-quality amino acids and essential oils that can improve the strength and the absorption. Other CBD's products, well, they aren't like ours. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain. And I'm not the only one. Thousands of other people have benefited from the healing attributes of these products worldwide. So check out our website at www.martyscobracove.com. It's legal, it's safe, and it's 100% effective. So show your pain no mercy.
So we are back on air, everyone, and after this commercial of the CBD product, and we are with our guest, Carla Yanni. So Carla, I love what you just answered with the students, and that is, thank you so much for doing that. I have a question here. This is not from someone, just a question from me, by the way. Just in case you thought that. Housing policies. How have the housing policies enabled discrimination according to class, race, and gender, despite the fact that deans envisioned the residence hall as a democratic alternative to the elitist fraternities?
Well, that has been a very... kind of contentious history. So if you take a step back, the residence hall is a kind of intimate space, right? You're changing clothes and using the bathroom and showering. And there's a lot of universities let, a lot of white universities, predominantly white universities, let African Americans take classes, but mm-hmm. they wouldn't let them live in the dorms. Mm-hmm. So each university has a very uneven history. An exception to that would be Oberlin College in Ohio, okay. which was integrated and coeducational in the 1830s.
Oh my
but
goodness!
Even yeah, it's it was
I did
a very,
not know that.
Yeah, it was extraordinarily in its time and still is in many ways. But even Oberlin went through a period where after this proud progressive history, they wouldn't serve African Americans in the dining hall and they asked them to leave. And then the students and the president protested, you know, the students protested and the president relented and eventually, you know, within a few years, African-American students were eating in the dining hall again. But so imagine this is a place that had been very progressive. African-Americans had been allowed to eat in the dining hall from the 1830s up to the 1880s and then were kicked out. There are also cases where an individual African-American student moved into the dorm, and the deans and white students asked her to leave, and the dean said, no, she's staying, you can leave. This was at the University of Chicago around 1900. Mm-hmm. And the dean said, no, if you don't like it, you, the white students, you can move out. But the president reversed their decision and forced the African-American student to move out.
Wow.
So it's been a fight every, you know, it has not been a smooth process. And I think that one little experiment that I've used to do is I would look on people on websites of colleges to find out who the first African-American graduate was. And that is always proudly displayed. Mm-hmm. On every website, but they never tell you when the first African-Americans were allowed to live on campus, because it turns out it's decades later. You know, a lot of colleges that were integrated, the African-Americans lived in boarding houses. Often in, you know,
and how far
with an African-American, yeah. Yeah, often with an American, you know, often in a home owned by an African-American. So the housing remains segregated, even if the college classroom was integrated.
Wow.
So it's a subtle difference, but it would have had a very real effect on the life of the students.
And I can imagine, but maybe I'm wrong, that geography-wise, that if you're saying that a Black American student would live in housing, that those housings weren't very close to the university or the college.
Right, that was often the case. That's right.
So that would create...
You know, one of the things that the deans tried to do was inspect all of these boarding houses to make sure they were safe.
Okay.
And that they were able to turn that into a way to make colleges and universities more egalitarian, because they could... If the landlord or landlady wouldn't rent to Black students, they would take them off the list of recommended boarding houses. Because in a lot of time, colleges are more progressive than the surrounding neighborhood, or you know, colleges were interested in integrating, but maybe the town wasn't. So mm-hmm. that was a way of trying to at least select boarding houses that would be more welcoming. But it was a very slow, difficult project. And you know, for those young African-Americans who integrated those big Southern state universities, that was a very brave thing to do.
Wow.
So.
Amazing. I'm just imagining how that must have been like for them. It can't have been easy. And there's a question I wanted to ask you about that, too, with race. Was the architecture built in such a way during that time so that they would have their own clubs within the university? Or am I just way too progressive here and that wasn't done yet?
That's not a crazy question at all. It depends a lot on the colleges and universities. I mean, I know of some colleges where the African-Americans formed like an African American union, and then, you know, maybe the college would give them a building or they would have rooms in the student union. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a very lively African American Greek life, but African American sororities and fraternities tended not to have their own residences. But I think that's more because they didn't have the resources, not because they didn't want to have their own residences. There were lots of opportunities for African-Americans students to form clubs and, you know, caucuses and so forth in order to seek greater representation on the faculty and so forth. There's a quite a well-written, well-known history of that at Rutgers, with a very lively, well-organized, principled African-American protest movement in the 1960s that really did a lot of good to make Rutgers a more egalitarian place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there wouldn't be anything about the architecture that would jump out at you in one case or another.
Okay. I have, this is not really a question, but one of the people on the website, it is a young lady. She is telling you, it's a compliment to you, really. She says this: your comments about the dorms being a place of exclusion really hit home. I graduated from MIT 2 years ago, and living on campus that first year was horrible. I am originally from Indonesia, so I am dark-skinned. I have a challenging accent, and I am a female, and not such a good combo, she said. No, young lady, that's a great combo. I bought your book on Kindle, she said, and it was a terrific read. Several of my younger cousins will be heading to college over the next 5 years, and I am absolutely going to make sure that they all have a copy and to prepare them for what to expect. Knowledge is power. I loved your images, Victoria.
And she's, how lovely. That's nice.
Yeah, she's living in British Columbia. But maybe you could address what your advice would be for her cousins that are coming, because if she says
they should come to Rutgers, I have a very easy solution. Tell them to come to Rutgers.
Okay,
it will not stand out at all. All of our, we have a
diverse campus. Okay,
we have among the most diverse large universities, flagship universities. It's, and New Jersey is a very diverse state, and I don't think having an accent or brown skin would make her stand out in any of our dorms. But not to make light of it. It can be very difficult to meet people even in the residence hall, because after all, it is most of the time random. You know, you might get assigned to a particular roommate based on preferences, but if there are 50 people on your hall, that's probably going to be a random selection of people, and you might not like any of them.
Okay.
So it can be a difficult transition.
Mm-hmm. I totally understand that. I'm just amazed that 2 years ago means that it was 2017. Yeah. I just hoped that we would be much further along. I'm brown-skinned myself. I was born in Pakistan and adopted by a Dutch couple. So I'm just a little saddened by reading this and encouraged that your book has...
And also, you know, MIT is far more diverse than Harvard or Yale or Princeton.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pulling those numbers out of my head, so I'm not 100% sure, but MIT is more diverse, especially it has a larger percentage of East Asian and South Asian students. Of course, you know, she's not.
So, Carla, we're unfortunately almost at the end. I need you to tell our listeners where they can find your book.
Oh, great. Well, you can buy it directly from the University of Minnesota Press. Okay. And there's a link on my website, which is www.carlayani.com. And you can also buy it from Amazon, and it's available on Kindle. And I would be thrilled if some of your listeners were interested enough to look at it.
Okay. And then everyone, Carla Yani, and please don't write this down, this will be on the website, is carlayani.com. But it will be on the website, so don't worry about that. And Carla, it was such a great pleasure to have you. I am sure Alan will want to have you back on, because I still have 6 more questions for you.
Well, that's very nice.
Show. And I want to really hear a little bit more even on the inclusion, not just the exclusion. So, yeah, I loved hearing this. So thank you so much. And for everyone out there, we will be next Monday. We will be back with Lisa Boucher. And I hope I said that correctly. I say it the French way, to discuss her new book, raising the bottom, making mindful choices in a drinking culture. So this fits perfectly after
the
college.
Yes, it's a perfect segue.
Isn't this a perfect segue? I love it too. And for everyone out there, guys, we're on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Facebook, Twitter. Please share. Thank you so much. And I am Gabriella Van Rey, standing in for Alan Cardoza, Answers for the Family. And talk to you. Have a great week and talk to you next week. Bye, everyone. And thank you very much, Carla.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Right here on LA Talk Radio.